Welcome to the Helping Children Thrive podcast, where we talk about ways to improve your child's health and recovery. I'm your host, Momina Salim, and I'm a certified pediatric functional medicine health coach. At Helping Children Thrive, it is our aim to educate and empower parents and practitioners with integrative approaches to children's health conditions. Along with this hope that our children can recover, I welcome you all. Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Helping Children Thrive podcast. Today, our guest is someone with whom I share a similar philosophy about food and its healing potential. Award-winning public speaker, New York Times best-selling author, and world-renowned health expert, Dr. Sarah Ballantyne, believes the key to improving public health is scientific literacy. She creates educational resources to help people improve their day-to-day diet and lifestyle choices and empowered and informed them by the most current evidence-based scientific research. Dr. Sarah began her career as a science communicator and health educator when she launched her original website, thepaleomom.com, in 2011. On this platform, Dr. Sarah combined her background in medical research with her experience using diet and lifestyle to mitigate a dozen diagnosed health conditions to create a wealth of educational resources and amass an audience of millions. Since then, Dr. Sarah has continued to follow the science, diving deep into immune health, metabolic health, gut microbiome health, nutritional sciences, and the compelling evidence for the health at any size, while also observing the harm of healthism, diet culture, dogmatic misinformation, and predatory marketing. With Nutrivore, Dr. Sarah seeks to create a positive and inclusive approach to dietary guidance based in science and devoid of dogma, using nutrient density and sufficiency as its basic principles. Nourishment, not judgment. Welcome, Dr. Sarah. That is such an impressive intro.
I am so happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
Yeah. One of the first things that I like to introduce our audience to you is what got you started in what you do today?
So I have a background in medical research, and I was on a sort of standard academic track when I had my first daughter, and very quickly realized that my physical health was a limiting factor in being able to balance an academic career with new motherhood, with a very challenging first baby, you know, one that was colicky and didn't sleep well. And we later discovered she had sensory processing disorder, and we didn't have support. We were living in a different country from our family. So it was a really, you know, tough experience for early motherhood at the same time as I was trying to establish my own research program. And it just became too much. And it became too much because I just wasn't healthy enough to burn the candle at both ends the way I would have needed to be able to launch my academic career. So I ended up taking what I initially planned on being a break from academia. It turned into sort of an accidental career change. But that space gave me time to work on my own health, to improve the health of my family. As we made diet changes, we discovered that both of my kids were having health issues that were related to food sensitivities. And I kind of accidentally fell into a whole separate career of science communication, health education, because I was sharing my experiences. And as a scientist, I'm a scientist by training and by nature. I can't turn that nerdiness off. So writing about the science that I was interested in learning about, I found an audience online of other people who were really, gosh, this is a pun, hungry for information that had that scientific background, right? That had that scientific basis, and that were really keen on understanding why certain food choices are better than others. And, you know, initially, you know, I found my place in the paleo community, but as I continued to follow the science and follow the science really tangential, sort of towards a more flexible and diverse diet, and towards a more nutrients first approach, but also a very sort of individual approach, right? Understanding our own bodies rather than applying some type of like, oh, you can't eat this whole food group type of dogmatic approach over top. And that's what really brought me to Nutrivore, was sort of getting established in the health and wellness sphere as a science communicator, first and foremost, and then caring about facts and caring about the scientific evidence and continuing to follow it to the point where I realized it was time to create something new. There wasn't a corner of the health and wellness sphere where I really belonged. It was time to make my own corner and hopefully bring people into this. I would say Nutrivore is a diet inclusive philosophy, because it's not a diet itself. You can apply it to however you eat now. And it's also very compatible with anti-diet principles, where we don't label any food as good or bad.
Yeah, you know, we're just going to get into Nutrivore in a bit, but I think just to kind of give some context. So when you did start Paleo Mom, it was really more from like a specific diet perspective. And so as you've moved on to Nutrivore, has it really come out of just this change that you've seen within your own health and your family's health and everyone that you've worked with?
That's a really good question. I would say it's actually the opposite. Sort of like workflow. So it came out of, I spent 6 years researching for a book that's on hold now, but I was researching a book on the gut microbiome. And as I really dug into that science and started to really understand, some of the foods that I was avoiding are really phenomenally good foods for our gut bacteria. And as I started reading that science, and nutrient density is a really important facet for supporting a healthy gut microbiome. So I was incorporating even more nutrient density into my understanding, even though that was sort of part of my earliest work as well. Reading that science is what compelled me to try foods that I had eliminated and had thought I would never eat again. And as I started to expand my diet, started to feel a lot better. You know, there were still some like health challenges that I was facing, and expanding my diet really helped to resolve some of those like lingering challenges. And then expanding my family's diet as well, you know, it really became clear that this was really important for our overall health. But it started with me reading the science and really like understanding that I was being too limited in my dietary approach, and that it was really important from a health perspective to expand. And then actually doing the work of implementing that and seeing the change and having that emotional sort of confidence that, yeah, this is definitely the right way to go.
Yeah, it's interesting that you talk about it just being, you know, this confidence that you get, because initially when you're confronted with this research that's going against everything that you've been advocating for and this like lifestyle that you're living, it's hard to kind of accept that. But it's a major shift. And that's why I wanted to know whether like you actually saw those changes within yourself, and which you did, which kind of justified making that and kind of broadening that whole you know, view of food.
Yeah, I mean, I think that if I hadn't seen the personal changes in how I was feeling, the scientific argument is so strong that I would have then interpreted that as I have some kind of food sensitivity to these foods, but overall these are good foods, and my communication would have reflected that. It's handy that I felt good, because you know, when we're trying to understand health, you know, there's whole scientific studies on like how people, like what informs people's day-to-day choices. And information is a huge part of it. That's the business I'm in, is like translating the detailed science for the average person. But experiences and observations are really important as well. So you seeing your neighbor on a health journey will talk you into doing the same thing that they're doing more than other experience, like seeing something on a TV show, for example. And so that personal health experience, when we feel really good, when we make changes, is a really important part of like the emotional buy-in to maintain those healthy changes for our whole lives. So when I'm communicating science, it helps to have that personal experience to draw on to make the story feel more personal and feel compelling and feel like you're seeing your neighbor on their health journey and that you want to do what they do. But at the same time, everything that I do is rooted in the science, and I really look for scientific consensus when I'm diving into the science. So even if something doesn't work for me personally, like I get very sick when I eat gluten, but not everyone does. It's not a super nutrient dense food, but I wouldn't label it as a bad food anymore. Like that's,
yeah.
I don't label foods as bad.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't judge someone for eating gluten. So I think it's really important in my communication that it's science first, and it's presenting the science as accurately as possible. And then my own experience just gets to be that extra little spice that
like the proof
makes
of concept.
Science less dry, makes it more compelling.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that this whole shift also is great, because what's happening now is within diet culture, and we work a lot, especially on this podcast, and I work particularly with children and with young people. This whole idea of restrictive eating is causing a lot of trouble and causing a lot of these mindsets. And you have children who are also young adults. And so they have this, you know, it's creating this trouble with children where they're restricting, restricting, restricting and labeling food. And we're setting up that example as well in many ways, where we're saying, you know, we're paleo, or we put ourselves in these different buckets and we're restricting foods, and it's causing a lot of damage to our kids.
Yeah, I agree. Our kids are learning from our example, right? But I think it's causing a lot of damage to adults. And I think when I see how harmful diet culture is, I think it's exactly that. It's how many diets are defined based on the food that you restrict or avoid or eliminate or obsessively measure. And I think what happens is, especially when we very simplistically define health as thin, you do one of these diets, you lose some weight, you will eventually hit your hormone and metabolic adaptations that mean that diet is not going to continue working, because that's what happens no matter how you lose weight. And so because it worked at first, when you cut things out, there's this like natural instinct to cut out more. And so we have these like layers of diets that are very popular right now that are like stepwise cutting out more and more and more things.
Yeah.
And I think what's happening is we're actually driving this underlying health problem of people aren't getting enough nutrients. Most people don't understand what nutrients do in the body, what foods contain them, like where to get those nutrients, how much of them we need. That's not part of our education. It's not part of how government dietary guidelines communicate about food. It's not part of any like mainstream or popular fad diet, how they communicate about food. And so instead we have 50, 60 years of this is a bad food. Now this is a bad food, right? Like,
yeah.
You know, we're all going to go low fat, and now we're all going to go low carb, and now we're all going to go, you know, paleo or vegan or keto or carnivore, right? We get these more and more restrictive eating patterns, and they're all defined by what we're cutting out instead of how do we choose foods to get enough nutrients to support our biological systems. And so we're starting at a point where the modern food supply is not super rich in nutrients. If you're not paying attention to your diet and you're just eating what you can afford or get in the store, chances are close to 100% that you have dietary shortfalls of essential nutrients. But there's no like healthy diet, and I use air quotes for that, that fixes that problem. And that was what I saw in the health and wellness community more broadly, was that all of these different dietary patterns are learned disordered eating that are magnifying nutrient deficiencies that are basically digging a even deeper hole in terms of our health that we need to somehow get out of. And so it's actually worsening our health over time. And sometimes what we're doing is we're trading that, you know, thin beach bod for our health. Sometimes we're not even meeting our weight loss goals and still trading that for our health. And even when we think it's health focused, it's so missing the mark, because we're not talking about the nutrients that your bodies need and the foods that you get them from. So that exact challenge, I think, in diet culture really informed not just the philosophy behind Nutrafor, but how I'm building all of the Nutrafor resources to be exactly that missing piece that all diets are missing, as understanding why we need nutrients and where we're going to get them.
Yeah. And so just getting into Nutrafor, one of the things that you focus a lot on is scoring food. And so I think even before doing that, just give us like a quick overview of what Nutrafor is, and then maybe you can go into a little bit more how this whole scoring system works so that people can learn about, you know, what their food means, what information it is.
So the goal of Nutrafor is very simple, right? The goal is to just get all of the nutrients that our bodies need from the foods we eat. It's a really simplistic, logical concept, and yet one that is actually quite radical because it's not actually integrated into most other dietary templates. And it takes understanding what foods have the most nutrients per calorie. That's where the score comes in. What foods have different types of nutrients, because it's not just about always picking the highest score, but about understanding which foods are unique sources of nutrients. And then you can choose those foods and then round it out with whatever you want, right? So like you can apply these principles to other dietary templates. If you have another rationale for eating a certain way, it helps you identify the most nutritionally valuable foods within whatever framework you're working in. So Nutrafor in that sense is a diet modifier rather than a diet itself, or it's a diet philosophy. It kind of bridges the space between anti-diet and what is currently happening in diet culture. And then what I'm building with Nutrafor is all of the tools to make that a reality. So the Nutrafor score is a nutrient profiling method that I developed. I developed it because, like, I started basically going, I'll go look at the scientific literature. There's lots of sort of nutrient density scores out there, and I'll pick one. I'll pick whichever one I think does the best job, and that's the one I'll use. And I spent 3 months a couple years ago reading almost every paper that had been published in nutrient profiling, and just kept coming up against this wall of, but they only included 9 nutrients in the score, but they're penalizing for sodium and saturated fat per food, when it's really the whole diet that is important when it comes to, like, there's certain nutrients where we definitely want to keep it in a happy medium range, right? There's certain things where the more the merrier, some things where we just, like, there's a range we want to be in. And certainly sodium and saturated fat are two such nutrients where we definitely need some, we don't want too much. So that didn't make sense. There were whole corners of this research where they were trying to retrofit a score to the healthy eating index, which is a measurement of how closely you're following US dietary guidelines. I was like, shouldn't we understand which foods are the most nutrient dense and then adjust the dietary guidelines if needed? And that was just not something I was seeing. And so I ended up feeling like none of these scores actually represent just the nutrients per calorie in a food objectively. They all have some were like penalizing for being in certain food groups, or they would normalize for a food group. So it would be a score out of 100, but so vegetables would be ranked from 0 to 100 and grains would be ranked from 0 to 100. And it's just not, it just didn't make sense to me. And so I developed my own. Algorithmically, it is very similar to the Nutrient-Rich Foods Index, but there's 33 nutrients that go into the score. And we've done a lot of work to track down nutrient data that is not in the USDA Food Central database, which is where that's our primary data set for the nutrition data. We've got data from other databases. We've got data from papers to try to give food as much credit as we possibly can. It's actually really shocking how many holes there are in, like, human knowledge about the nutrients in foods right now. And so it ends up being a score where there's no maximum. Right now, I think the highest score is about 14,000 and the lowest is 0.
Oh, goodness.
It's basically just, it's a measurement of total nutrients per calorie. And what I have done in building Nutrafor is use that as a lens through which to view foods rather than try to, like, tweak this algorithm to make it make sense for my preconceived notions. Instead, I am understanding foods in a different way because I can see this number. And it's been like really illuminating. It certainly shows you the power of vegetables, right? Just how amazing those are. It really shows how phenomenal fish and shellfish are. It really shows that we, you know, there's no reason to be avoiding fruit. Fruit is great. Legumes are great. Nuts and seeds are great. There are some grains that are really nutrient dense, and most are kind of underwhelming, but it also kind of busts the myth of empty calories. Yeah. There's very few foods that, they tend to be this like very ultra processed foods where you can kind of go like, yeah, that is absolutely calories for no vitamins and minerals. But whole foods, you can just really see that all foods lie on a spectrum. There's not an obvious line to kind of draw this line and go above this is a good food, and below this is a bad food. But it really helps to like show these dietary patterns that we see in the scientific literature, which is like whole foods and vegetable forward is kind of how I think of it. So lots of veggies, but not plant-based is sort of, you can really see that reflected in the data. So it's just one tool that I've created to help us understand Nutrivore. I've created other tools like the Nutrivore Weekly Serving Matrix, which is much more about understanding nutritionally distinct foods rather than how foods score. So it's about understanding the value of different vegetable and fruit families, for example. And I'm working on more resources that are very practical focused and designed to help us implement this idea, right? Choose more nutrient dense foods. And still have room in our diet for what I think of as quality of life foods. And so because of this lens, looking at foods, it actually creates this whole space where we can have a much more balanced approach to how we choose foods and a much healthier relationship with our diets and ourselves and our bodies. And we can really get away from the food judgment that I think has done us a huge disservice since the 70s.
Yeah, for sure. You know, when you talk about this, like the range, the scoring from like 0 to 14,000, for example, how do people pick and choose, like the parents that you've, you know, you probably use the scoring and put that into your weekly matrix, right? So, you know, I'm a mom and I'm the one who mostly makes most of the meals at home. How am I thinking about this and incorporating all of this information into my weekly meal plan or daily, you know, food choices?
Yeah, I think there's two ways to go about it. So one is the like really relaxed way, which is to use the Nutrivore score not as a day-to-day tool, but as a way to understand the big patterns, right? And so what they show us is that vegetables are really important. So we can start thinking about what's the vegetable or two vegetables or three vegetables at every meal. It shows us how valuable seafood is. So can I incorporate fish at least a few times a week? So we can, part one is to kind of understand the hierarchy of different, they're not really food groups, they're more, I typically call them food families, right? They're highly related foods. They're more granular than how we typically divide foods into four or five food groups. So it would show us that cruciferous vegetables, the cabbage family, are really important, that leafy vegetables are really important, that winter squash is, you know, like the best in the starchy vegetables, right? So it gives us this way of understanding the big patterns, and we can kind of let go of like worrying about the number and just think about, let's make half of the plate covered in vegetables. A quarter of the plate is some kind of protein food, and a quarter of the plate is some kind of starchy food. And let's have most of that be whole foods. And then let's flavor it how we want to flavor it. Let's use healthy fats to cook it. And then there's room for whatever, the granola bar, right? The easy snack, you know, like those convenience foods that actually make a big difference in terms of like making our lives like sane. And when we can make our meals like in that very balanced nutrient focused way, then there's a lot of room that then if you want to have dessert, you can have dessert and still meet your nutritional needs, right? Mm-hmm. So it kind of, there's like, that's one way to do it. So one way to do it is just like use it as a way of understanding the big patterns and then don't sweat the details and follow the big patterns. The other way is to get super nerdy and granular about it. And so you can say, okay, look, I'm going to have a green vegetable on my plate for dinner tonight. Now I'm going to look up the Nutrivore scores of the 10 green vegetables I know I can get at my grocery store. I'm going to look them all up and I'm going to see which one's the highest. And you'll probably find that it's like collard greens or mustard greens or rainbow chard, right? Those are all in the like 4,000 to 6,000 range. And so you're going to go, okay, now I'm going to put that on my list. And now, okay, I know I'm going to need a starchy vegetable. I'm going to look up what's the most nutrient dense starchy vegetable I can get. It's probably something like sweet potato. Okay. I'm going to make collard greens. I'm going to make sweet potato. And now I want a really nutrient dense protein. What's that going to be? Shellfish is too expensive. We're definitely not having oysters for dinner. No one's going to eat that. Okay. Oh, look, salmon. Salmon's like 900. Okay. I will put salmon down on this list. Now I'm going to look online and find my recipe that uses all these things. And I'm going to figure out how I'm going to cook them. So that's the like really nerdy, granular meal planning way to do it, which would be to figure out each piece of your plate and then choose one of the higher score options while making sure that it's within your budget, within the tastes of your family. And that's something that you can actually access at the grocery store. On Nutrivore.com right now, you can search our entire database of about 8,000 foods and look up their Nutrivore scores. There's a lot of really obscure foods in that database that you are not likely to find in a store. The only way you're going to get them is if you live close to a really cool farmer's market, or if you like to garden and grow some of your own food, like, or if you're traveling. So there's some really unusual foods and a lot of high-ranking foods that are not easy to find. So so the practical way is to you're not seeking perfection. There's no such thing. And there's a million different ways that you can combine foods and achieve this Nutrivore goal of meeting your body's nutritional needs with foods. It just takes sort of like unlearning some of the diet myths that we've been taught over the last few decades and then relearning anew, or generally for the first time, learning how to choose foods so that you're getting that full range of nutrients. So there's five really distinct vegetable families. So that'd be cruciferous vegetables, the cabbage family, mushrooms, alliums, the onion family, and then leafy vegetables and root vegetables, which are more about plant part than the family they're from. And then seafood would be your most like nutrient dense, and beneficial animal food. And so when you can kind of think about it in terms of like, even just that simplistically, fruit's really great. Herbs and spices are a different thing, right? There's lots of value to many other foods. But if you think of it simplistically as, you know, seafood is going to give me things that I can't get easily from other foods. And those five vegetable families are going to give me something I can't get easily from other foods. How am I going to incorporate those throughout my week? That's a really easy starting point for most people. And then round out with other foods. Don't make it just that. You don't eat just foundational foods. You still get to build your meals around those foods. But that's a really great starting point for understanding sort of like how to combine foods to meet our nutritional needs. There's actually very few species in the world that survive on like one food. Like pandas are very unusual and they have to eat a whole lot of bamboo in order to meet their nutritional needs. They have special gut microbiomes that help them liberate the nutrients from the bamboo, and that shifts with different seasons. Like it's actually really cool, but we don't have like our nutritional needs cannot be met by any one food or any one food group. So really one of the best things we can do, especially if we want to take the more relaxed approach, is also then just try to eat as many different foods as possible. So just try to think of how often I can mix it up. And sometimes that green vegetable was chard. Sometimes it'll be broccoli. Sometimes it'll be green beans. Sometimes it'll be asparagus. Like, how can I swap that out so that we're getting as many different foods over the course of about a week as possible?
Yeah, I think just that, just having a list kind of also shows and teaches you diversity and gives you options. Because a lot of times when you're sitting and thinking about meal plans, it just, you know, you get stuck in that rut of whatever you mostly cook. And so seeing it on a list kind of helps you push that that boundary. But what about, you know, either parents or adults or kids who have, deficiencies, right? And they want to try to use this Nutrivore approach to feeding those deficiencies. How do you look at that?
So I think it depends on exactly what deficiency we're talking about and how bad it is. So with an actual deficiency, if you were looking at a disease of deficiency, like scurvy or rickets or pellagra or beriberi, You're talking about a situation where it's going to be very hard to address that deficiency with foods. There are great food sources of those nutrients, but if they're generally not concentrated enough to be able to make up the difference quickly enough to be able to alleviate a disease of malnutrition. So if we're talking about a real deficiency that your doctor said, hey, this is a big problem, you're kind of stuck in supplement land, at least initially. And then you can migrate as you restore levels in the body enough to not be having those health issues. Then you can start looking at your food sources of those nutrients. When we're talking about insufficiencies, which is like, I know my kid never gets enough calcium, then we can be more targeted. We can look at like, what are the best food sources of this nutrient? And then cater that to what they like. I think that's one of the challenges. Kids don't often get to a point of nutrient insufficiency or deficiency because of the foods available to them. That certainly can happen, right? Especially in food insecure households. But it's more commonly something like a picky eater who, of course, picky eating phases are absolutely normal, who is not eating any foods that supply that nutrient. In which case, got to meet our kids halfway. Like that is, again, it's a normal developmental phase. My oldest daughter was a very picky eater as a result of sensory processing disorder. And so catering to the foods that they like, or there's so, I mean, I am absolutely not against hiding vegetables in a muffin. Yeah. Or making popsicles with vegetables or putting it in a smoothie. Like we can, there's nothing wrong with those strategies. Mm-hmm. I don't believe in like healthifying the cookie in order to alleviate ourselves of the guilt of eating the cookie. Like just make a cookie that you're going to like, right? When you need a cookie, have a cookie that nourishes us in a different way than nutrients. That's a different thing. But when it comes to like improving our nutrient intake and using those strategies to help us or our children eat something that we normally find really challenging, then I think that's a great tool. So I think, again, if we're talking about nutrient insufficiencies, this is where talking to your doctor, making sure you understand what the level of deficiency is. Do we need to do a supplement to bridge that gap for now? And then, looking at what are the food sources of those nutrients and the alternate food sources, right? So I mentioned calcium earlier. Dairy products are the top. They're the most concentrated food source of calcium. That's the reason why dairy products have the reputation as being good for your bones. But they're not the only food source of calcium. So in my household, three out of the four of us cannot tolerate dairy. And so we look at other food sources like green vegetables tend to be good sources of calcium. Mushrooms have some good amount of calcium. Oranges, nuts and seeds have good amounts of calcium. So we look at sort of calcium equivalents is how my doctor would say it. But we can find those other food sources that will make up that gap and give us a good amount of calcium so that we can be like, again, nutrient replete with calcium, even without that like easy calcium food of dairy products.
Yeah, I totally get that. And, and I also understand areas where we need to like bridge that gap. And one of the things that you talk about, and I think it's on your website as well, is that why you don't recommend like a daily multivitamin, right? Mm-hmm. Is it because it becomes our fallback and we kind of use that as a crutch for the rest of our food? Like what's your reasoning behind that?
So the reason is they don't work the way that we think they should. So we think of multivitamin, multimineral supplements as nutritional insurance, right? Like it's what makes sure we get the vitamins and minerals we need when our diet doesn't supply enough of it. And there have been a few really large meta-analyses. So those are studies that pool data from a bunch of other studies to really determine the magnitude of an effect. They are some of the highest level of like quality scientific evidence we have that have shown absolutely no improvement in health outcomes in people who consume multivitamins, even if on paper it looks like they're getting enough nutrients. So if you kind of look at how much nutrients a person is getting from diet plus supplements, it doesn't work the way you would think it would. So you would say, okay, look, you know, there's a bunch of nutrients, for example, that if we don't get enough, it increases risk of cardiovascular disease. People who get enough nutrients, but a large part of that is made up with multivitamins, they don't have the reduction in cardiovascular disease that you would normally expect from meeting those shortfalls in nutrients. And there was a really big paper in, I believe it was 2019, that actually divided exactly that way, the nutrients from supplements versus the nutrients from food, and found that when nutrients came from food, they were protective, and they were not protective when they came from supplements. And in fact, calcium from supplements was potentially harmful. That's obviously in a high dose and it's context dependent.
Warm, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah.
But it's more, it's just a waste of money. If it's not actually doing the thing that we think it's going to do, it's be far better to take that money and put it towards more fresh vegetables, for example. You know, and that's not to say that there's never a time and place. I just said with severe nutrient deficiencies, supplements are our path out of it. And that's, you know, definitely the case with vitamin D deficiency, for example. It's really hard to address vitamin D deficiency with sunlight and food. But as a like nutritional insurance, like just taking the multivitamin to make sure I get all of my nutrients, the science just isn't there to say that it does anything beneficial for us.
Yeah. And, you know, I totally understand that. And it kind of resonates and sounds a lot like what Deanna Minnick, I don't know if you're aware of her work, and she talks a lot about, you know, just eating a variety of color and, you know, eating the rainbow. And so it's when you're trying to consume your vitamins and your nutrients through multivitamins, you're kind of missing out on this whole important spectrum of phytonutrients that you're getting through food. So like just the color. And so it's, you know, a multivitamin is becoming our cop out in some ways. A lot of times.
Yeah, exactly. And even, I mean, there are some more expensive brands of multivitamins now that have a fruit and vegetable blend in them in order to deliver some phytonutrients. But, and certainly, you know, the studies aren't evaluating those supplements separately from other multivitamin supplements. They might be better. I'm very skeptical. I think you just can't. You know, from food, we tend to have nutrient synergy. We tend to have nutrients found in the same food that are going to work together to aid absorption or throttle absorption so that you don't get too much of something. They're going to typically be the nutrients that work together in a system in your body. And especially when you start balancing meals, then you're getting nutrient synergy from multiple different foods. And there's, especially with phytonutrients, right, there's 50, 60,000 different phytonutrients that we know of. Maybe a couple thousand of them have actually been well studied. And the main thing we can say about phytonutrients is the more, the better.
Yeah.
The more phytonutrients we get overall, the better our health. You know, there's a couple of exceptions, right? If you're a smoker, too much carotenoids can increase your risk of lung cancer. There's a few places where like the more, the better isn't necessarily true. But as a general rule, that's you know, the more of those we're getting, on average, the lower our risk of a bad health outcome. And the only way we're really getting that full diversity is from whole fruits and vegetables, right? Nuts and seeds, plant foods, basically, are what supply that. Tea, coffee have lots of phytonutrients as well, like chocolate. Chocolate's packed with polyphenols. But that's something that we just aren't, like, supplement manufacturers aren't even really thinking about how to get non-essential nutrients that are still really important into a pill. And there's other things, right? Like fiber supplements are complicated because they're one type of fiber, which basically means they're feeding a handful of bacteria species, which is actually propelling imbalances in the gut, even if it might be fixing, you know, some kind of constipation or diarrhea type issue, but they're not helping to support a healthy gut microbiome. And most people don't get enough fiber. So, and there's no supplements that are like diverse fiber sources. The only way you're getting that is from fruits and vegetables. So I think, you know, could you craft a multivitamin that actually, you know, had all of these different non-essential nutrients and had the right balance and actually did work and dissolved in your stomach, so it was actually absorbable and all of those different things? Like, maybe, like, you know, I science is amazing. It's probably possible. I just don't think it exists right now.
Yeah. And so for parents that are listening in, right? A lot of parents, they have children with various chronic conditions. What can they take away from this, and how can they, you know, use this in their daily life? We did talk and allude a little bit about how kids can have picky eating issues. And so for them listening to this, it's extremely overwhelming. But what should their takeaway be from this?
So, I mean, I think the main, like, if I was going to say, here's the three, like, things to do to be your first steps for Nutrivore, it would be choose more whole and minimally processed foods. Frozen foods and canned foods are minimally processed, and they're almost the same nutritionally as fresh. So there's a accessible option there. Be veggie forward, right? So like the more fruits and vegetables forward. So trying to be intentional with increasing fruit and vegetable intake, and it doesn't have to be, you know, 0 to 100 in 0.6 seconds. You can slowly build up on that. And then the third would be to diversify, to eat as many different fruits as possible. So I would say all of those are really, really hard with a picky eater. And I had one, and she was borderline failure to thrive at 1 year old, because she just didn't eat. And we discovered later that it was a gluten sensitivity, and she had a stomach ache every time she ate. So she developed aversions to everything. And plus with sensory processing disorder, she really didn't like textures, different temperatures, strong flavors, and she had a really hard time with anything chewy. So it's typical with sensory processing kids to have lower muscle tone, and she certainly had lower muscle tone in her jaw. So anything that needed to be chewed, she was terrified of choking. It was a really tough challenge. And we got through that with a combination of catering to her likes. So she liked steamed broccoli and she liked steamed green beans. Those were the only two vegetables she liked. So we had one or the other at every dinner. I didn't always eat them. I often made something different for the parents, because eating just steamed green beans and steamed broccoli was just going to like make me go crazy. But I just made sure I always had that. And then I tried to get her to have one bite of something else. We know with kids that familiarity is a really big part of how they develop food preferences. So that one bite rule really does work over time. And also positive associations are really important for developing food preferences with kids. So my husband and I both are professional improvisers as a hobby. So we would do these like improv games as like dinner table games, where we would like go around the table and we would all say the next word in a sentence, and say a story by all just saying the next word or saying the next sentence. We're playing like alphabet games. And what we would have as the rule is, before your next turn to contribute to this story we're building, you have to put one bite of something in your mouth. And so it became like there's like a reward system, but it wasn't food-based reward.
Yeah.
And it was, we were doing something fun as a family while my daughter was eating something that she found really challenging. So we kind of did that combination. I won't say that I was perfect. There were definitely times where like, I just was over it and I lost my patience. So also know that we're human and that's a normal experience that could happen. It took a couple of years to slowly build out her palate. We did some occupational therapy to work on a lot of the sensory challenges. We just went very, very slow. And now that same kid is 16 and her diet is phenomenally diverse. I mean, I'm in a phase right now where I'm like enjoying cooking a lot of new flavors. I go through phases where I'm like, I only want to keep it simple and I only want to cook something I know everyone will eat. And then I'm bored of that. I only want to cook things I've never cooked before. I'm in the latter phase right now. And I have not yet made something that she hasn't liked. I mean, every single new bold flavor, she's like, wow, this is so good. It took so long to get there. It took a lot of patience and diligence. I used to do things like put broccoli in muffins and called them greensicles because they were green popsicles. So I used to make, you know, pureed vegetables that way and catering to her tastes and slowly expanding her palate. It took a very long time. So I think the other thing is to remember as parents, right, that the job is never really done. I mean, eventually they'll be self-sufficient adults and then the job is a lot less intense. But it's okay if it takes time. And I would say I would pair that with age-appropriate conversations about food, about why this food is good for our bodies, why this food can make us healthier, without ever calling the other foods, right? The, I know my kid will always eat this food, or the treat foods, right? The birthday cake, the whatever. Without calling those bad, you can emphasize why broccoli is so good. And I think that that combination of catering, conversations, patience, positive experience, slowly expanding the palate, all of those things together, and again, it was a long, long process. But that's, we got to an end. You know, it took about 2 years where I could then say, wow, my kids have a really great diet now. And it's just continued to get better since.
Yeah, I think that is just such great hope for a lot of parents, including me. I've spoken about this many times, about having a child who is a selective eater, who's expanded his palate over time. And like you, it's taken time and patience. But we're not there 100%, but we still keep working on it and trying to tweak and make changes. And but it's also to make space for that and to allow that to basically evolve as time goes. And so I think that that your story is one of great hope for a lot of parents, right? Where we do talk about the importance of the Nutrivore concept of including a vast variety of, foods in our diet, but then also looking at these little humans that are struggling and how we can have patience and hold space for them to grow into that.
Yeah, I think, again, my first child was my, she broke me in as a parent. She's always been the kid who has been high effort and high reward. I mean, she's just an amazing human being. And I received a lot of parenting advice, as I think a lot of us do, unsolicited parenting advice early on, right? Make her finish her dinner for breakfast if she won't eat it. Make her sit there until she finishes her breakfast. Like all of these actually traumatic experiences from when we were kids is not good advice. And I, I didn't follow that advice in part because my instinct, I knew it wasn't going to work.
Yeah.
And I'd love to say I was confident enough in what I was doing, but honestly, I was just trying to do my best and was, struggling with what's the right way to move forward and second guessing a lot of what I was doing. And I can say in hindsight that it worked really well, but there were lots of times in the middle where I was like, we didn't always know that what we were going to do was going to work. And it's only on hindsight that we can say, yes, it was great that we employed all of these strategies to help our kids diversify their diet and learn to eat healthy foods. So I think that, if I can say anything, it's like that self-doubt is normal. The frustration is normal. The worry is normal. And the feeling like you're being judged, right? The feeling like you're not a good parent because you're having these struggles is also normal. And that's, you know, it's not true as much as I do, but I know that inner critic can be a pretty loud voice sometimes. And so I hope that my story helps give everyone confidence that that what they're doing is going to pay off in the future, and just understand that often the most sustainable changes we make, or maybe always, the most sustainable changes we make are the ones that we go in baby steps and we do iteratively, and those tend to be the changes that stick with us. And so think of it that way. Think of it as that, slow iterative improvement. What's really important is that you're taking steps in the right direction, even if they're infrequent and small steps. And keep, just keep going. It will get better.
It does, right? And I think that your story gives so much inspiration and hope. So thank you so much for coming and sharing with us, the whole idea behind Nutrivore, but then also sharing your story of hope with all of us.
No, thanks again for having me.
I hope you enjoyed our conversation today. Thank you for listening to this podcast and spending your precious time with us at Helping Children Thrive. If you find this podcast helpful, please share it with your family, friends, and others who may benefit. If you haven't already, hit subscribe so you don't miss any episodes. Please take a few moments to rate and review this podcast on the review section of Apple Podcast. This will help other parents, caregivers, and professionals find the show more easily. Visit MominaSaleemCoaching.com to post comments on today's show or ask any questions about upcoming episodes. And sign up to receive weekly updates. Helping Children Thrive is not a substitute for working with a qualified healthcare professional. The information shared here is not intended to diagnose and treat your child. Before implementing anything discussed here on the podcast, make sure to consult your healthcare practitioner. See you all next week.